forcing deportation orders, the politics of Cuban musicians playing in South Florida, and the cost of resiliency in the Florida Keys. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The Trump administration is ramping up enforcement of deportation orders against undocumented immigrants. Meantime, the number of Cubans held by U.S. immigration authorities has skyrocketed since the end of the wet foot, dry foot policy. Over 8,000 were held last year. Two local governments want to silence Cuban musicians playing in their cities. Hialeah canceled the 4th of July performances by Cuban groups, and the city of Miami wants the federal government to allow city governments to ban Cuban performers if they do business with the Cuban government. Plus, the high cost of keeping higher seas out of the Florida Keys. It's all ahead on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.
Hi, I'm Jenna from Coconut Grove, and you're listening to the South Florida Roundup. Now, here's Tom Hudson.
Jenna, thank you very much for helping us out on this special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. Great to be with you this week. And we start with immigration in South Florida and our community. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, reportedly is preparing for mass arrests across the country. The agency is targeting people whose final deportation orders have been issued by federal judges. Earlier this week, President Trump announced as many as 1 million people would be impacted. Now, his administration has since walked back that number a little bit. According to the New York Times, ICE's director said agents would target more than 2,000 people. It's unclear how many of those may be in South Florida. Now, the Trump administration has shifted its immigration deportation efforts from focusing on those who have committed violent crimes to all immigrants, including Cuban nationals with legal status. So this is where we begin this South Florida Roundup here. What could be the impact in your community, in your neighborhood? Perhaps are you worried about your family or coworkers? The text line is open here on this special pledge edition. You can text us at 786-786-7636. The threatened ICE deportation enforcement orders are first up here on the South Florida Roundup. The text line again, 786-786-7636. Danny Rivero and Tim Padgett, a couple of our reporters here at WLRN that have been following along this and other issues regarding immigration. First, Danny, what do we know about these possible immigration raids or enforcement actions?
So one thing to keep in mind is it's been a little bit of a changing thing from day to day. President Trump made the announcement that he was going to deport millions of people just prior to his official launch of his 2020 campaign. Some have suggested, you know, there was a politics at play with that. The logistics of actually removing millions of people over a short span of time, there's really serious logistical questions as to whether that's possible or not. But acting ICE Director Mark Morgan has said that basically they're going to prioritize people who have already had final orders of deportation, start there. It's not exactly clear how they're doing the targeting, if they're going to go to workplaces, if they're going to go to people's houses, if they're going to go to check-in centers when people are checking in with ICE.
Mm-hmm. So, Tim, these are, as Danny mentioned, final deportation orders that have been issued. What does that mean? How does that, intersect the immigration community?
Well, in a lot of instances, you have people, let's say, who were requesting asylum and didn't get that approved. They're given a certain amount of time then that they have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, you know, they think, well, I can get an appeal process. Once all that is exhausted, they're in this limbo where, no, you've got a final order to leave the country to be deported, and that's when an agency like ICE, you know, usually swoops in, particularly if the person has any sort of criminal record. And that was usually the priority in the past, but that's been thrown out the window.
I want to explore a little bit about that, right? Mm-hmm. So a criminal record and violent crimes that mm-hmm. Have been adjudicated and deportation orders issued against those folks right. That have committed those crimes, that's one thing. But for instance, what about somebody overstaying a student visa? And if they have been ordered this final deportation order, are they susceptible, vulnerable to this kind of action?
Before President Trump took office, that instance, that kind of immigrant with the final notice for deportation could usually rest easy, knowing that the, as I said before, that the priority was for migrants who have committed especially felonies. That was always the priority for the Obama administration, for example. And the Obama administration deported so many of those people that they got called deporter-in-chief. Mm-hmm. But now it's become so much more generalized. And that student that you're referring to now is as ripe a target as the person who's committed a felony.
The text line is open, 786-786-7636. The possibility of ICE enforcement of final deportation orders has been raised by the president this week, to announcing that it would begin in the following week. That would be next week. 786-786-7636 is the text line. Danny, you have been doing some reporting regarding the changes of the immigration policies as it relates specifically to Cubans coming into the United States. And there have been big changes over the past couple of years. What's the new data on how that wet foot, dry foot policy, and since the ending of that policy, has meant for immigration enforcement actions regarding Cubans coming to the U.S.?
Well, there's two things that happened at the same time. President Obama, in the last couple of days of his presidency, he ended wet foot, dry foot, which of course means if you cross a border or you reach land from a boat, you automatically have kind of a legal pathway. That was ended right as President Trump was coming into office, mm-hmm. and he changed the priorities. So we are seeing, I got data this week from the federal government, from ICE, that shows the it was over a 700% increase in Cubans being detained by ICE. Now that's not necessarily only people at the border. Typically, if you cross the border, the Customs and Border Patrol will pick you up. So if you're being detained by ICE, that's typically in the interior of the country. That's you, right. You getting arrested and the local law enforcement turns you over, something of that sort. So that's people inside the country. So that's gone up very, very sharply. And when it comes to deportations, similarly, it's still a pretty small amount of Cubans that are being deported, but it's shot up very dramatically percentage wise. It's over a 700% increase in that. For a long time there was not really undocumented Cubans.
Right.
There's a lot of people of Cuban nationals that are here that actually have these final orders of deportation. But part of the issue is that Cuba as a country won't accept them.
Yeah.
You can't deport someone to a country that won't accept them. So a lot of them have just kind of rested easy, knowing they're not going to get deported. And then now we hear that there's going to be these raids that they're going to target these people. So that brings up a lot of questions.
Yeah.
How are we going to feel that in South Florida?
Yeah. What about the receiving end of these deportation notices, these final deportation notices that presumably are going to be enforced in the coming week, as said by the president, and his ICE director has not walked that piece of this statement back. Tim, what do we know about the receiving countries of these folks that...
Well, All we can assume is that it'll look a lot like the ICE raids we've already seen under President Trump, I think. As I said before, it was much more surgical in the past, not just the Obama administration, but the George W. Bush administration, the Clinton administration before that. It was much more surgical in the sense that they were going after a particular type. And they would come into a community and people could assume that, well, they're going after that guy who, was convicted of armed robbery, a couple months ago. But now... As we were discussing before the show here, it could be a person who's going in just to check in with immigration officials, mm-hmm. which we've seen time and time again under the Trump administration. A person who thinks he's sort of following the rules, and then all of a sudden gets handcuffs clapped on him, and he's on a plane back to Guatemala.
Got a quick question on the text line here from Gary from 305. Is the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, involved in deportation efforts?
Not in terms of the actual process of deportation. I mean, logistically, sure, but not in the process of who gets nabbed.
Yeah, this is a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. Immigration will be one of the topics that we will be discussing at one of two live town halls ahead of the first Democratic primary debates next week. The town halls will be held Monday and Tuesday night right here at the WLRN studios, hosted by WLRN's Sundial host Luis Hernandez and our news partner, the Miami Herald. You can find more details all about the town halls if you're interested at WLRN.org. Still to come, Hialeah cancels some Cuban acts for its July 4th concert. That's coming up on this special Pledge Edition of the Roundup.
I'm Eric.
I'm Isis.
From Pembroke Pines, you're listening to the Florida Roundup on
WLRN.
Now, here's Tom Hudson.
Oh, you guys nailed it, Eric and Isis. Thank you very much. It takes all ages to make South Florida Roundup possible for you. And welcome back to a special Pledge Edition. Great to have you along. That's Cuban artist Jacob Forever. He's one of a few Cuban artists who are expected to perform at a July 4th Independence Day concert organized by the city of Hialeah. But then the city canceled several performers, likely including him and other Cuban artists. Anti-Castro exile groups in South Florida protested the performers over their support of the communist regime. Univision reported this week that Hialeah's city commission approved a $30,000 contract in its budget for Jacob Forever's performance. So what do you think about this kind of cultural exchange and the tension it brings? Should Cuban artists be able to perform here in South Florida? Have you attended one of these concerts by a Cuban artist? Have you boycotted it because perhaps of their support of the communist regime back on the island? Send us a text. The text line is open on this special Pledge Edition, 786-786-7636 here on the South Florida Roundup. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. WLRN's Danny Rivero and Tim Padgett still with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Tim, this effort to kind of pull support from a Cuban artist, a musician that is due to play here in South Florida from a musician that has done some things that have been seen as supportive of the communist regime back on the island, either directly or indirectly, is not new. We've had this debate for a good number of decades here.
Exactly. I mean, I first wrote about this back in 2000 when the Miami City Commission was trying to pass a similar ordinance. At that time, it was a familiar target, the Cuban salsa band known as Los Banban.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also during the Elian Gonzalez episode here, and it was, you know, it was sort of a gesture on the part of the Cuban exile community here to reassert its authority,
yeah,
vis-a-vis Cuba. So you're right, this is not something new at all.
This is Los Banban right now, celebrated their 50th anniversary here in Miami. So
right,
despite the fact that the debate is more than two decades old, right, the music continues.
They're celebrating at private clubs like Miami 60 and Wynwood, I think, and that shows you how things have changed in that regard, though, because 20 years ago, even private clubs would have been, I think, intimidated against inviting a band like that because of the backlash they would have gotten from politicians.
Danny Rivera, what about the political clout of the exile community extended over, you know, I mean, the 60-plus years, of course, of the Castro regime, the communist revolution, but more particularly here in the 21st century? To Tim's point, you know, 20 years ago, even private clubs probably may not have taken that risk.
Well, absolutely. I think it's a shifting landscape. I think the reality of who the Cuban community is here has shifted over time,
right,
with more newer arrivals, kind of going alongside people who have been here for decades at a time. There's a difference of opinions, and there's also just frankly a difference in people's connection,
yeah,
to the island and the culture from the island. You know, one of the artists that was part of this cancellation of the concert, Jacob Forever, I mean, he's a wildly popular artist.
YouTube video with 103 million views.
Wildly popular. I mean, he was a former member of Gente de Zona, mm-hmm, Latin Grammy winners. Mm-hmm. He's if you listen to Ritmo 95, like I do, a reggaeton station,
yeah,
here, he's basically the godfather of it. He's on it all the time. And people are fans of it. You know, as a Cuban-American myself, the Cuban music is one of the biggest exports of the country as a culture. And that has always been the case, even with the embargo. And, you know, this is for the first time that I'm seeing it as kind of in my adult life, like, okay, the city's making or cities or municipalities are making policy about this. You
right.
know, this music has kind of been something that in a lot of ways on the dance floor people agree with, but now politics are coming back into it in a way I haven't seen necessarily in my adult life.
I think one of the problems here is what developed during the past few years after Obama normalized relations with Cuba and a lot of the cultural connections got bigger and bigger was I think there was perhaps a fallacious attitude on the part of some Cuban artists that, well, things have changed entirely in Miami, and I can just step off the plane at MIA wearing a Che Guevara T-shirt. Mm-hmm. That aspect of things has not changed. And if you are a Cuban artist who's going to come in here and telling the community how much you love Che Guevara, you can realistically expect some backlash.
And
still.
That's a reference to Jacob Forever, who was,
exactly.
I think, in social media streams, had a Che T-shirt right. on back a couple of years ago.
Whereas Los Bonbon, it's much more nuanced. Sure, they opted to stay and live in Cuba. Sometimes they played nice with Fidel Castro. But if you listen to their songs, one of my favorite Los Bonbon songs is Mi Chocolate, which is a real angry complaint about how all the women in Cuba back in the 90s were being carted off by European mm-hmm. guys because of the economic crisis.
So there are two kind of things happening here, right? I mean, there in terms of what's happened the last few weeks with Cuban artists playing in South Florida. One was the Hialeah situation where there's this Independence Day, July 4th, of course, you know, America's birthday. With Cuban artists that had been invited, in some cases perhaps contracted at a pretty significant sum of money, a five-figure sum, that went through presumably the process with a city council vote, but only to have those invitations pulled back after the Cuban exile community became more vocal and stated its opposition. Then there's also the action that the City of Miami Commission has been discussing, led by Mayor Suarez, which is to ask the federal government for the okay for local governments to essentially, prohibit artists that have connections to the Cuban government from playing in those communities in the United States.
Specifically in city or municipality owned venues. So the Los Bonbon did have something on the calendar for next week to play at the James L. Knight Center, which is a City of Miami owned venue. It's mm-hmm. that concert's canceled at this point. But yes, they're asking for permission to be able to not contract with people based on that criteria. And I think Congress hasn't responded to it, but if you take it to its conclusion, you have to ask, well, where would that take, the cultural exchange here?
Yeah.
Jacob Forever has played in American Airlines Arena. Mm-hmm. That's leased by Miami-Dade County. Mm-hmm. If Miami-Dade County adopted a similar resolution, would he not be able to play there?
Yeah.
You know, even if it's contracted under the Grammys. Jacob Forever just a couple months ago played at Calle Ocho Festival. Mm-hmm. That's on public streets that are permitted. Would that be impacted? I don't really know the answers
to
that.
Yeah, lots of questions here. What are yours? And how do you figuratively or literally hear this when the debate around politics here in South Florida and the relationship with Cuba, which is so nuanced and complex and historic, is drawing in Cuban music and Cuban art again and still. 786-786-7636 is our text line and a special pledge edition here of the South Florida Roundup, talking with Danny Rivero and Tim Padgett, both of WLRN. You can join that via the text line, 786-786-7636. Cultural exchange is the category, Tim, that has been used certainly since President Obama in 2016, mm-hmm. 2015 began to open up relations. How is that used? Is it being misused, as some will point to in these kinds of exchanges? And just kind of where does that sit within the activity of the transfer of art and culture between the island and South Florida especially?
Well, it's been thriving quite a bit in the past few years. I mean, we're seeing, you know, Cuban painters and sculptors and filmmakers, et cetera, and musicians, et cetera, who would have been very, very much intimidated about coming to Miami, 20 years ago, who, have been coming back and forth quite freely and quite enthusiastically. I think one of the problems here, and this is something, for example, that local politicians like Joe Carollo have raised as well.
City of Miami Commissioner.
Exactly. If we're receiving all of these Cuban artists, why won't Cuba allow in Gloria Estefan or Willy Chirino, who are outspoken critics of the communist regime in Cuba? Now, a lot of people might say he's got a point. Others, however, have weighed in with me saying, why would we want to lower ourselves to the authoritarian level of the Cuban regime by behaving in that way? And I think that argument, for a majority of not just Cubans, but a majority of South Floridians, holds sway over the opinion of someone like Joe Carollo these days.
Just to add to that, there's been also, at the same time, reluctance for larger artists here to play on the island, kind of self-imposed reluctance. Gloria Estefan has publicly said, I don't want to play there until X, Y, and Z happens. Yeah. Pitbull has said, I don't want to play there until X, Y, and Z happens. At the same time, kind of more local-level artists have been doing cultural exchanges. I mean, I'm friends with the band Afro Beta. They went there last year. You know, I know they have personal opinions about the Castro government, but they went there as a cultural exchange, and they were able to do that.
What do we know about the connections that these Cuban artists have with the government? Because that has been a point that the exile community has pointed to in the successful cancellation of some of these artists playing at the Hialeah July 4th concert, and some of those that are supporting the effort in the city of Miami to have the ability to prohibit these artists from playing on municipal venues.
That's the problem. That it's so hard to define who is a pro-regime artist. I don't think hardly any artist, except the most, you know, dyed-in-the-wool ideologues who are probably paid by the Ministry of Culture anyway in Cuba, would ever come out and say, well, I am a pro-Castro artist. They have opted to stay on the island for personal reasons, many of them. They're only pro-regime in the sense that they do what they have to do to survive there, to not get thrown in jail. And you do have some artists who do regularly get thrown in jail there. But the problem here is that if we start labeling any artist who has opted to stay on the island as pro-regime, we're missing out not just culturally, but intellectually on understanding the island better. Mm-hmm. You take a novelist like Leonardo Parduro, whose detective series was made into a Netflix movie last year. He is very critical of the regime, but in subtle ways that don't usually, you know, that your typical politician here often doesn't understand.
Yeah, it's a way of playing in between the lines and knowing the dance of what you
exactly
can and can't get away with. And I think to the point of this Hialeah cancellation, one of the artists that was on the bill that's no longer going to be appearing is El Micha, another very big artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's publicly said, listen, I've had concerts canceled on the island. You know, they have more respect for me in Miami. And then now he finds himself on the bill. You know, part of the fact is he lives on the island. And I don't want to speak for him about his personal thoughts and opinions about the government, but now it puts him as an artist kind of in a rough place. He feels like he has more respect here than his concert just got canceled, and he obviously has problems with the government there.
Talking about the intersection of art, culture, and local politics here on the South Florida Roundup, Danny Rivero and Tim Padgett, thanks for sharing your reporting with us, as always, here on the Roundup. Appreciate it. Thank you. We do want to remind folks that we will be holding two town halls ahead of the first Democratic primary debates. The town halls on Monday will be focused on immigration, on Tuesday on climate risk. They'll be held right here at the WLRN studios, hosted by WLRN Sundial host Luis Hernandez, our news partner, the Miami Herald, also involved. If you're interested, we would like your RSVP. You can find all the details and click through the graphic that you'll find on our homepage at WLRN.org. Still to come on the South Florida Roundup, a report estimates that it could cost billions of dollars to build seawalls in the Florida Keys, keeping the Keys resilient. That's next on the Roundup.
I'm Cindy White from Davie, and you're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Here's Tom Hudson.
Cindy, thank you very much. We couldn't do the South Florida Roundup without your help. We appreciate it here on the special pledge edition of the Roundup. And now talk about resiliency in the Florida Keys. Coastal communities across South Florida are working to make themselves more resilient against the threat of rising seas, certainly. It's a challenge for the Florida Keys, no doubt about it. Here's the Monroe County Sustainability Director, Rhonda Haig.
The answer to Monroe County for long-term livability here is going to be learning to live with water.
Now, a new report that was released this week finds resiliency comes at an awfully high price. An advocacy group called the Center for Climate Integrity estimates it would cost more than $400 billion to build seawalls to protect the nation's public infrastructure. And in Monroe County, the cost would be $11 billion. It's the highest in Florida and the second highest of any amount of any county in the country. So what's your experience with frequent flooding, not only in the Keys, but maybe in your neighborhood elsewhere on the mainland? Do you live somewhere that's putting up seawalls in your neighborhood? Did you vote for recent bond referenda that allow for public investment in seawalls? What about raising roads and putting in pumps? The threat of rising seas in the Keys and here on the mainland in South Florida here on the Roundup. Our text line is open, 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. Nancy Klinger is with us from our southernmost bureau at the studios of Key West. So, Nan, seawalls in the Florida Keys, how practical is that as this study was putting a price on resiliency as it relates solely to seawalls? Can that protect the Keys?
No. My first reaction to this study was that it projects us, you know, having this insanely high cost and that we would be building 1,151 miles of seawalls.
Something that the Keys is not likely to do, perhaps even stronger, won't do because it really wouldn't help.
It wouldn't help, yeah. Rhonda Haig, whom we heard from earlier, points out that, you know, because of the geology of the Keys, the water comes up from underneath, you know, so even if you had a seawall that was somehow keeping the tide out, the water would still be rising.
Yeah. In fact, listen to what Rhonda told us earlier this week.
Certain many areas that are low-lying roads, the water comes in, even if it's not a shoreline road, it comes in from underneath in the low-lying area. So that's already occurring. So no, that's not the answer. Seawalls are not the answer.
So, you know, lots of intellectual capital spent on this study from an advocacy group for a solution that really is just non-existent for the Keys.
Right. And, you know, I was on a call earlier this week with the study's authors, and I had questions about that, as did people from other areas of the country where things like salmon runs and other wildlife.
In the Pacific Northwest, yeah, sure.
Right, exactly. And they said that they don't expect everyone to be building seawalls, but that they wanted a consistent national measure to come up with the costs of climate change. And their goal here is to basically get local communities to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable in the way that big tobacco and now the opioid industry is being held accountable for the costs.
Well, so maybe, right, the conversation less about the particular tools used for climate resiliency, in this case a seawall, and more about the conversation about the cost to address the risk of climate change. $11 billion in the Keys for seawalls that aren't going to be built, wouldn't be built. But what about that kind of price tag when it talks about resiliency for solely Monroe County?
Right. Well, the county's major effort right now is on elevating roads that flood frequently. And they've already got two pilot projects underway, one in Key Largo and one on Big Pine Key, to sort of test out how it works, how much it costs, what it means. And they said they're learning a lot. And they've also hired an engineering firm to survey all 300 miles of county roads and figure out which ones need to be elevated, how high they need to be elevated, how soon they should be elevated, and how much that would cost. And Rhonda told me that's looking right now at between $2 and $10 million a mile for those roads. And those costs obviously vary widely depending on, you know, how much you have to do. And also because they have to, under state law, they have to treat the stormwater when you fix a road up.
So. And so, you know, what does that mean, $2 to $10 million a mile to raise county roads in Monroe County? Number one, I mean, what kind of cost are you looking at there, Nan? And two, is that really a viable So is it the solution when your chief sustainability officer in Monroe County talks about having to learn to live with water?
Well, that is learning to live with water, having the roads higher, having your houses all built to current code. That's been a major emphasis, of course, especially since Hurricane Irma. But really, since the 70s, you know, that's why all these houses in the Keys you see are up on stilts already. Mm-hmm. That's the county's primary emphasis right now. And they're also, like when they built a new fire station on Stock Island a couple of years ago, they built it so that the floor would be dry under 50-year flood projections.
Yeah. What about the other kind of public infrastructure that's involved there? And I'm thinking specifically of utilities, both electric and water. Which for Monroe County has, you know, some special circumstances around the delivery of both those utilities.
Yeah, they're definitely keeping those in mind, and it's not just, I guess, climate change is a factor too for the water because of the saltwater incursion in our well fields up on the mainland. So we're looking at doing more reverse osmosis, you know, to make fresh water out of seawater. And lots of stuff like that. And there's also concern about the airports, of course, because they are quite low-lying.
Governor Ron DeSantis was in the Middle Keys this week, and he brought some money along with him, saying that he had $35 million in his pocket, so to speak, and some state money for affordable housing as part of an allotment of FEMA money for affordable housing in Florida. Monroe County getting a good chunk of that. Where does it go?
They're hoping to work with private developers on that one, for sure. They're looking for applications to the Florida Housing Finance Corporation, starting very soon in July.
And how does this relate to the continued kind of cleanup and response to Hurricane Irma?
Well, it would definitely provide more workforce housing. I mean, they're calling it affordable workforce housing. So the aim is not, you know, for people to retire to the Keys. It's for people who, you know, can be here and work in our hotels and in our schools and in the hospitals and the police agencies. So that would definitely help a lot with recovery. I mean, certainly the businesses here and the public agencies say that's their biggest problem in staffing is just keeping people here who can't afford to have somewhere to live.
And so how does an effort like this, do you think, Nan, get greeted up and down the island chain, not only from the county's perspective, but also some of those more individual municipalities, some of whom, you know, are property tax based, and let's face it, have seen their budgets expand as the property values have expanded in the Keys, thanks to second and third home buyers.
Yeah, I mean, they're happy to see additional units for the people who actually work here, for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're employers themselves; they depend on those local businesses. So the local municipalities are generally much in favor of this. The possible exception of the county's unincorporated areas, some of which are the more rural areas that don't want to see new developments that will possibly change the quality of the neighborhood and also add more cars to the highway.
Yeah, and certainly put more strain on emergency management planners during storm season, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, the state's approach to that has been saying you can have 1,300 new units. You just have to tell them to leave earlier than everybody else.
Yeah.
And we have yet to see how that might actually play out in real life.
Finally, this week, when it comes to Irma in the Keys here, almost two years on now, the governor also announced that the county is getting $21 million reimbursed for the cleanup costs.
Right. That's FEMA money. And, you know, it's this really long and involved process for the reimbursement. It goes to the state first. They review it. Then they send it up to FEMA. FEMA approves it. And then they send it back to the state. And that's just been taking a really long time for a lot of these. And the governor and Jared Moskowitz from the Department of Emergency Management have said that they are really intent on speeding up that reimbursement process, both for the Keys and for the Panhandle after Michael, because they know that these governments are, you know, trying to get ready for another hurricane season while they're still out that money.
And still paying back the money that that Monroe County especially borrowed and other communities borrowed in the weeks and months after Hurricane Irma.
That's right.
Nan, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Nancy Klingener watching over the Keys from our southernmost bureau at the studios of Key West here on WLRN. Finally, on the roundup this week, we remember former Barry University president Sister Jean O'Loughlin. She passed away this week. She was 90. Here's WLRN's Alexandra Gonzalez.
O'Loughlin first came to the job in 1981. The school was in debt, students were leaving, and South Florida was in the midst of its cocaine cowboy reputation and had just experienced the McDuffie race riots.
One day I remember I got down on my knees by my bed and I said to the Lord, "Lord, this is your institution, and whatever you want me to do, I will do. But I'm really worried."
This is O'Loughlin speaking to Barry University in 2015. She kept her word. She was bet $1 million to put on a white satin dress and sing "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina" aboard a millionaire's yacht. The song is from the musical Evita.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is, I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence.
That's the beginning of us getting out of debt. And I never thought that the Lord would answer it in a prayer by singing "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina."
O'Loughlin was also recognized for her civic activism. She fought against illegal drugs, homelessness, and for immigrants' rights. She got involved in the Elian Gonzalez case. In 2000, she hosted a meeting between the boy and his Cuban grandmothers at her university-owned estate in Miami Beach. Here's what she told reporters at the time.
Whenever this community has called upon someone to serve in any capacity, I felt the answer should be yes.
After the meeting, O'Loughlin believed the child couldn't return to his father in Cuba. The U.S. government ultimately sent Gonzalez back to the island. A wake for Sister O'Loughlin will be held Monday night in her home state of Michigan. Barry University plans to hold its own memorial service on a future date.
And that will do it for the South Florida Roundup this week.
This is Hillary Kaxer in Miami Beach. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre.
This is Ryan Wilson in West Palm Beach. Teresa Frontado is the digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard.
I'm Claire. I'm from Boca Raton. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mayertz. WLRN's director of radio programming and the show's technical supervisor is Jason Zabka.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, texting, and especially supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.